Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the summit between Donald Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un ended without an official agreement. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? You won't learn from reading the New York Times editorial, which both lauds a step-by-step process by which both sides agree to take corresponding action, and says that outreach to dictators like Mr. Kim erode the moral foundation that for generations has supported American diplomacy and the notion of America's role in the world. The last thing you'll get from U.S. media's assessment of the prospect of peace on the Korean Peninsula, what Koreans think. We'll talk about the just-concluded summit with journalist Tim Shorrock. Also on the show, when the New York Times talks about the moral foundation supporting American diplomacy, you have to wonder, do they mean diplomats like Elliot Abrams, holder of a number of titles in the Reagan and George W. Bush administrations and now special envoy for Donald Trump in Venezuela? And if they do, do most Americans understand what media's definition of the word diplomacy or the word moral really entails? We'll talk about Elliot Abrams and the press with John Schwartz, journalist for The Intercept. That's coming up this week on Counterspin. We're told the summit between Trump and Kim Jong-un has ended with no agreement. That may be received as good news by, say, the former CIA chief of staff that MSNBC brought on to warn viewers that Trump's bromance would lead him to cave on nuclear weapons, and to the think tank expert whose op-ed in the LA Times explained that the long-sought-after recognition of the end of the Korean War might sound innocuous, but is actually dangerous, because it might lead to a real peace treaty on the peninsula and, quote, if South and North Korea were to be in a formal state of peace, what would be the rationale for keeping 28,000 U.S. troops in South Korea, close quote. You can be forgiven for being unsure exactly what's going on here, but we would hope that a baseline idea would be that arguments against peace should get serious scrutiny. Joining us now to talk about the Hanoi summit and Korea peace talks is journalist Tim Shorrock, author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. He joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Tim Shorrock.
Hello, thank you.
Well, the fear, as far as I could understand it, was that Trump in this summit was going to agree to loosen sanctions or allow for a peace declaration on the peninsula without North Korea agreeing to eliminate all of its nuclear weapons capacity first. Or, as an expert source told USA Today, quote, we've said this over and over, if you choose to give up nuclear weapons, you can have a better life, close quote. But then we also heard the idea that the de-escalation of tensions between North and South Korea would itself be bad. Well, for somebody. I don't know that the outcome of the Hanoi summit is going to shake up media's basic storyline. What are we seeing here? What's going on?
Basically, a complete inability to tell the story, see the story through Korean eyes. Like, for example, when last year, when Trump and Kim met in Singapore for the first ever meeting between a U.S. president and a North Korean leader, they agreed on a set of principles, which was, number one, establish a new relationship between U.S. and North Korea. Number two, that they would establish a peace process on the Korean Peninsula and you know, work with South Korea to deepen a peace process. And three, that they would work toward the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. And so for a lot of the press, they just see that as the first two elements of that aren't even considered.
Right.
That's the framework. For example, I woke up yesterday to turn on MSNBC when the very first, when the summit was just beginning, right? And Mika Brzezinski from MSNBC, she just said over and over again, you know, meeting with a murderous dictator who starves his people, murderous dictator who starves his people, murderous dictator who starves his people. I mean, it's a form of propaganda. So, you know, yes, he's a dictator, but actually, no, people are not starving anymore, but that doesn't seem to matter. But they just say this over and over again to just denigrate the whole idea of meeting someone like that. And you know, the fact that the two leaders are meeting and trying to work out a peace is just seen as a negative and even almost a crime. I mean, here's what's ironic about it is her father, Zbigniew Brzezinski, was, you know, the national security advisor to Jimmy Carter when he was president in, you know, 1980, when there was a murderous dictator in South Korea who, when there was a rebellion against the military government of South Korea, the U.S. under Carter helped put that rebellion down. They decided to side with the military one day after this murderous dictator had killed hundreds of people in a southern city in Korea. And Brzezinski, her father, was directly involved in that. He's the guy that really, you know, set the policy. So apparently she doesn't even know the history of her own family. But, I mean, it's just this unbelievable hypocrisy.
Well, I think it has to seem a little bit funny to people just coming to it earnestly, reading these articles, that the United States gets to decide when tensions end between North and South Korea, that the Pentagon gets to nix, you know, improved railways between the North and the South, you know, and you sort of get the feeling from coverage that South Korea really can't be trusted with their own interests, which I guess they're meant to say are our interests. It's confusing genuinely if you are not a cynical person to understand where someone who believes in peace and a de-escalation of tensions should find themselves in all of this.
Right, it is. It's terribly confusing for people. The attitude toward North Korea is one thing. And then the attitude toward South Korea among the mainstream media is that basically doesn't exist as a country. It's like a colony. They're supposed to just do whatever we say. And you know, a lot of times articles are written and reports are made that, you know, yeah, like you said, don't trust the South Koreans. They're moving too fast and, you know, making peace with the North. I mean, this is their own country. This is a war that ripped apart their country. You know, 4 million Koreans at a minimum died. Maybe, you know, 35, 36,000 American soldiers and soldiers from other countries as well. But, I mean, it was a terrible, terrible war.
There's an extra muddling to the picture because for some media, the problem seemed to be if Donald Trump gets any kind of a deal, we'll never hear the end of it. You know, and he'll ask himself to get the Nobel Peace Prize, and then all our heads will explode. Hatred of Donald Trump is not a legitimate reason to oppose a negotiation. And I just want to ask you finally, like, what do you, people interested in peace, what should we be looking for in terms of the media coverage coming out of this summit?
Well, I think we should look to see if it continues the same. I mean, what we've been seeing over the last few months is a stream of reports based on, you know, think tanks like the Center for Strategic and International Studies, which is funded by the military-industrial complex, and some governments like the U.S. and Japan. But they get a lot of money from defense contractors that assert that, you know, North Korea has, you know, continued to, you know, build its nuclear weapons and missiles while these talks have been going on. And first of all, there's a fallacy behind the reports in general because there is no agreement yet.
Right.
I mean, the United States hasn't stopped deploying its nuclear weapons aimed at North Korea that are stationed on ships and planes in the you know, Pacific, you know, in Japan and Guam. Yes, the hatred of Trump and the desire to kind of, you know, nail him and get him is so clear in the reports. I mean, last night, watching this live press conference from Hanoi, a few White House reporters got called on at the beginning, but then he started taking questions from, South Korean and Chinese reporters, and some a couple British reporters, and who were all interested in what had happened and how the talks had apparently failed. The fourth question was from Jonathan Carl of ABC News. He immediately, asked him about the test lawyer,
Michael Cohen,
right. And then after the press conference, when these network people do these stand-ups, right, they're all complaining that Trump had not gotten questions from the White House press, instead had gone to the foreign press, because they all wanted to ask about Cohen. I mean, they're so wrapped up in this, as if, Korea as a country just doesn't exist to them. The White House press corps, by and large, is not even providing the information that Americans need to understand what's going on.
Well, I'm going to end it there, and thank you very much. We've been speaking with journalist Tim Sharrock. You can still find his piece, Why Are Democrats Trying to Torpedo the Korea Peace Talks, and other related work online at thenation.com. Tim Sharrock, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
Difficult as it is for some of us to believe, there are many people for whom Elliot Abrams' appointment as Donald Trump's special envoy to Venezuela is their first introduction to the man, a recent Washington Post headline described as trailed by mistrust. Abrams' public record in Latin America and elsewhere as an official under Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush ought to be central in any reporting on his current Venezuelan adventure. But it only really got on media's front burner when Abrams was confronted with it by Representative Ilhan Omar in a House Foreign Affairs Committee meeting, an exchange then subsumed in media's hot controversy of the day framework. Joining us now to talk about some of Elliot Abrams' keenly relevant and not that old history is John Schwartz, contributor to many outlets. He now writes for The Intercept. He joins us by phone from Brooklyn. Welcome to Counterspin, John Schwartz.
Thank you so much for having me on to talk about this. It's an extremely grim story, but also extremely important.
Well, after the exchange with Representative Omar, Elliot Abrams sent a message to the Washington Post that described his role in the Reagan administration, saying, quote, "It's a remarkable record of support for Latin democracy, of which Representative Omar is obviously unaware and in which she is uninterested," close quote. And he added, "That was clear from her conduct, which constituted attacking rather than questioning a witness." The idea that Omar was speaking from ignorance, set aside her purported incivility as the conduct with which we should be concerned, but the idea that she was factually wrong, that she doesn't know her history, for reporters to let that stand as if to say who's right depends on who you like, it feels like an abdication of duty. So I wanted to ask you to talk about Elliot Abrams' public record, some of which you have revisited recently. We don't have time to do it all justice, but what leaps to mind when you hear Abrams tout his support for Latin democracy?
Yeah, well, Elliot Abrams supported Latin American democracy pretty much like Jeffrey Dahmer supported all the people that he brought to his apartment. That seems like a crazy thing to say to people who are not familiar with Abrams' history. It actually is not. Like, I'm choosing Dahmer specifically because a famous forensic anthropologist visited Guatemala to help excavate the mass graves there, many of them from the 1980s when Abrams was helping to support the Guatemalan government and make sure that it had all the arms and training that it needed for its military. And that anthropologist said this, it's a shame that Jeffrey Dahmer never came here to Guatemala, because if he had, he would have ended up as a general. The violence that Elliot Abrams supported in Latin America during the 1980s, particularly in El Salvador and in Guatemala, is unspeakable. human beings literally do not have the words to describe this kind of thing. And all we can do is use the limited vocabulary that we do have to try to communicate it.
Right. And, you know, I think in particular, when Omar was asking him about El Salvador, if we can start with that, because it isn't just that he described what happened in Salvador as a, I think, was his words, a fabulous achievement. I'm not sure, but just that for years afterwards, he continued to deny that any horrors had taken place, right?
That's right. Elliot Abrams in the early 1990s was asked about, you know, his involvement with U.S. policy towards Central America and El Salvador specifically. And he called what happened in El Salvador a fabulous achievement. Well, here's part of the fabulous achievement. Elliot Abrams became Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights and Humanitarian Affairs on December 12th, 1981. Literally when he walked into his office, the Salvadoran military, which was just off of being trained and armed by the United States, was conducting one of the most notorious mass slaughters anywhere on Earth over the past 40 years or so. This took place in El Mozote, which is a small town near the Honduran border in the mountains of El Salvador. It was kind of Milai times two or three. Around 1,000 people were killed, men, women, and children. Every woman over the age of maybe 10 was raped before being murdered. It is as gruesome as pretty much anything in human history. So he walks into office as the Assistant Secretary of State, let me say this again, for Human Rights and Humanitarian Affairs, and he snaps into action and covers it up.
I mean, I really actually want to talk about language here, because it's almost as if the stuff that you're talking about is on the record. It isn't that folks deny that these things actually happened. It's as if, yes, they happened, but you have to look at it through a particular lens. And so I want to say, like, you almost don't have to hide this record of what Elliot Abrams did in Latin America if you are going to at the same time say that, for example, in Venezuela, well, we're going to push for a coup for democracy, you know, and you're just going to say those words with a straight face. And so in some ways, the lying, and you've written about this, the lying and the PR and the massaging of the truth is as much a part of what we need to know about Elliot Abrams as what he actually supported.
Yeah, just the language is remarkable. It is like someone saying, you know, well, I'm a doctor, so I'm going to shoot you in the face for your health. And the El Mozote story, this is very much a media story. One of the things that Abrams and his compatriots in the Reagan administration did when Raymond Bonner was a New York Times reporter, got into El Mozote, he broke the story of what had happened there 6 or 7 weeks afterward. And the Reagan administration did everything they possibly could to try to, you know, knock the story down. They attacked Raymond Bonner personally, and they succeeded. Like, they went straight to his editors at the New York Times, and they got him pulled off of his assignment in Central America, brought back to New York, put on a desk that was a clear demotion. And it really just derailed his career, frankly, for decades. And so that's what happens when you report the truth in the New York Times. If you're going up against Elliot Abrams, you are going to be punished, and punished severely.
Well, and that record of his involvement with the press is part of his record, you know. And for some folks, as you've noted, it isn't just that he, well, I mean, it is that he attacks them, but it's also that he kind of breaks them, you know, reporters that are trying to rely on him as a source and trying to report reality from areas in which he has influence, some of them just get kind of worn down, it sounds like.
Yeah, I wrote about one who was working for the Washington Post and had to deal with Abrams. And she later said that, you know, they said that black was white. Although I'd used all of my professional resources, I had misled my readers. And she just found dealing with them so unbearable and exhausting that she quit to write novels.
Well, and then, you know, I guess I have to come back to, you've started to talk about, or you've indicated some of the actual horrors. You know, horrors is the right word for what was done under U.S. auspices and with U.S. support in Salvador, in Guatemala, in, we could also talk about, you know, Nicaragua, for example. And let's talk about actually Nicaragua, because that will be another example that for many folks might be, oh, wait, he has something to do with Iran-Contra. But this brings us back to journalists are now going to be going to Abrams, quoting him as a source. And these are journalists who have to know that he has a record of lying and proudly lying to Congress about U.S. Involvement in Nicaragua.
That's right. He's best known for, you know, if he's known for anything, is that he pled guilty to two counts of withholding information from Congress about the Iran-Contra affair. And when this happened, you know, everybody kind of thought, well, that's it. You know, you can't lie to Congress and, you know, return to the U.S. government at some point. And that's the funny thing about Elliot Abrams. He was pardoned by George Bush number one, as George Bush number one was on his way out the door after losing to Bill Clinton in 1992. You know, he pardoned a whole bunch of Iran-Contra people. One of them was Abrams, so his record was wiped clean. And that was the end of his career, you know, in the Reagan administration, but he would return later on for George W. Bush and do pretty much the same stuff.
Which is funny because they thought maybe he couldn't get Senate approval, but they found a way around that.
Yeah, that's right. So they put him on to National Security Council positions, again, with names in his titles, like involving human rights and democracy. And it's kind of like John Bolton, who's Trump's national security advisor. Like, it'd be very tough to get a Bolton nomination through the Senate. And so you can stick these people in the National Security Council, which does not require that kind of approval.
And they can have enormous, enormous influence, which I think, you know, we're seeing right now. You know, now Abrams is being covered in the context of Trump administration policy in Venezuela. And we're seeing, for example, stories about whether or not weapons might be smuggled in humanitarian supplies. And it's almost as if, let's come to that as though it's a new thing, you know, with regard to Abrams. Missing the history is always a bad idea for media. But when it comes to Abrams, it really means missing the story.
It is incredible. It is like, you know, reporting on Elvis Presley and be like, is it possible that this fellow might like to sing some songs? You know, I mean, like, this is what Elliot Abrams does. Of course you have to expect they're going to be smuggling arms and then humanitarian supplies. Like, he did that in the past. He's in charge now. Probably that's what he has in mind.
Nowhere along the line did he say, that was a mistake. I'm changing my ways, you know?
Yeah, exactly. You know, if he were truly remorseful for what he did in the past, he would not be getting hired again.
Well, let's come back to media. I wonder if I can ask you, because I do think it's the big story in some ways. You wrote in a recent piece, you reminded readers about when Elliot Abrams was on Charlie Rose with Alan Nairn, and he kind of said, you know, here's what I'm about, and here's how you should deal with it. Can you remind us of that story?
Yes. So this was 1995. Abrams was on the Charlie Rose show with Alan Nairn, you know, who is one of the best and most knowledgeable reporters about U.S. foreign policy. And Nairn said that George Bush number one, this is again 1995, had talked about putting Saddam Hussein on trial for crimes against humanity. And Nairn said, you know, like, that's a good idea, but if you're serious, you're going to have to be even-handed. And so you're going to have to prosecute people like this guy that I'm on the show with, Elliot Abrams. And Elliot Abrams found this idea, you know, preposterous and chuckled about it and says, like, well, you know, if you want to do that, that would mean putting all the American officials who won the Cold War in the dock. And that actually is a pretty fair point from Abrams. It's not like he somehow fooled Ronald Reagan, that he fooled George W. Bush. I mean, they knew what he was doing. He was doing what they wanted him to do. And this is U.S. foreign policy. This is what it's like. You know, there are doves and there are hawks, but the difference between them is not that great. And if you were going to put the hawks on trial, if you're going to be honest about it, you're going to have to put a lot of the doves there too. And so to me, this kind of stuff is always like murder on the Orient Express, right? So somebody ended up dead. And the question is, well, who killed them? You know, the story is, well, there are, I think, 13 possible suspects on the train, 13 passengers. The answer is they all did it.
Right.
They all committed the crime. You know, Abrams sees that as a very powerful defense, and it is. Like, the U.S. foreign policy elite does not like the idea of all of them going to jail together.
I kind of feel that elite media co-sign that line of thinking, you know, that they sort of play both sides in terms of their foreign policy coverage. This is for grown-ups, you know. You just got to accept as access to the conversation that, you know, we kill people and we do that to protect our stuff, you know. And then out of the other side of their mouths, they say, this is for the babies, you know. Don't you care about the poor babies? I mean, you know,
Well, why don't you care about the babies like we care about the babies?
Exactly. I just finally, for those of us trying to make sense of the world with media, how do you even do that? I mean, you can't rely on corporate press.
You know, I would encourage everybody to, you know, watch Game of Thrones. And there are a lot of great scenes in Game of Thrones, which I think demonstrates how these people look at the world. You know, particularly the character of Tywin Lannister, where it's like, look, somebody has to rule the world. Here we are. We're ruling it. Anybody who's going to rule the world is going to have to do this kind of stuff. So get over it. And in the end, it's for the best for everyone. And that really is how the U.S. media sees things, you know. And if you push them on how they don't really seem to care about a lot of babies on Earth, they'll retreat to that perspective. Like, look, this is just the way the world is, and suck it up and deal with it.
Right. Well, I guess, finally, for those of us who don't subscribe to that, we need to find other outlets for our conversations and other folks to include in those conversations.
Yeah, I mean, the good news is that we have 99% of humanity on our side. So hopefully eventually that will count for something.
We've been speaking with John Schwartz. You can find his work on a variety of issues on TheIntercept.com. John Schwartz, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you to everybody listening. I mean, this truly is an important story, and I think that it really deserves everyone's attention.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. The show is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York, online at fair.org. The show's engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.